Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Hello and welcome to the Emerald Podcast Series. I'm Nick Walwork, the Senior Commissioning Editor for Business and Finance, and our guests today are Lindsay Garner-Knapp and Tamara Mulhern, co-editors with Joanna Mason and Eliane Visser of Informality and Policymaking, weaving the threads of everyday policy work. Lindsay is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy at the University of Sussex and Cardiff University, and Tamara is an assistant professor of strategy at Newcastle Business School, Northumbria University. Thank you, Lindsay and Tamara, for joining us today. Perhaps we can begin with you telling us a bit about your backgrounds in policy and what led you to write this book. Lindsay, perhaps you could start us off.
Sure. Hi. It's great to be here today. Thank you for having us. So my background starts, I was a trade policy analyst and a policy advisor for several different governments in Canada. So with the government of Alberta, the city of Airdrie, but I've also worked with the Scottish government and Essex County Council before. So coming from multiple different levels of government has been a wonderful experience and really informed me as a practitioner and then me as a practitioner coming into academia.
Thanks, Lindsay. And Tamara, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so I have a background in history in public service, primarily in the kind of human services in areas of housing, homelessness, community sort of development, working at local government and at a state government level. And then I moved to Scotland and I worked in local authorities and in the NHS, typically around how care services are arranged for various different groups of people in our communities. Sort of practice background really also shaped my interest in doing a PhD because I was very curious about certain sorts of things that kept mulling in my mind as I moved through my career. And I felt that a PhD would be a great opportunity, a great way to really spend some time thinking deeply and doing work on those issues. So it very much informs my PhD.
Could you tell us a little bit about how your practitioner experiences shape what you noticed or didn't notice in academic literature?
I did an ethnography of managers who were having to implement Scottish government policy. And it was around the health and social care integration, which is kind of it's been a long-standing topic in the UK for over 20, 30 years because of the effects of having these two very distinct ways of organising interact in people's lives. And I'd been a manager, I'd worked at, you know, the City of Edinburgh Council in social care. And so in a sense, I was doing an ethnography in a different place, lot of people a bit like me. And because it was a rural area, I had to travel in various ways, you know, public transport. But it became clear to me that when you start to do an ethnography and the practitioners that you're with start to get to know you, there's a whole array of things that are going on that is not said and done in meetings. And bizarrely, cars are a place, they're a bit of a safe space for disclosing all sorts.
I did actually receive a cryptic note I should ask you about following managers in their cars across rural Scotland. So perhaps you could address that concern.
Yeah, well, those spaces afforded certain sorts of conversations to be had. And I could observe a number of things, but those experiences also resonate very much with my experiences in Australia because I lived in rural parts of Australia. And as a manager, I used to have to drive. We're involved in implementing government policies on various sorts of things, but you'd have to drive to places. You had to drive weekly to Melbourne. And I'd also had various experiences, like one day I had to chauffeur the Minister for Health, who flew into this really remote airstrip, and I had to drive her around. That was really fascinating. So there was my experiences doing my ethnography really resonated with certain things that happened in my experience as a practitioner around the car. And it was what is afforded by this kind of space. There are things that happen inside cars which are not documented, which are said elsewhere and regarded as safe. So there's a sort of freedom in disclosing but to see all sorts of things happen and the consequences of that have effects. So having those experiences and then the conversations with Lindsay and others then go, well, we need to do something about this. We need to write about it.
when I've worked with different governments, also in Canada, a very large country, there were many times when I would travel with my bosses, the senior staff, and I remember you'd share food, you'd share conversation, you'd share pieces of yourself in these journeys. You don't sit in a car for 4 hours and not share a piece of yourself. And what we found during those things is the affordances that come from those moments that weave into the rest of the relationships.
Yeah.
Policy folk or public administrators are people. These are people doing this work. This work is not done by robots. And so the relationships that you develop in all of these different spaces. So your piece in this book and in other spaces talks about the cars, and Joanna and I write about what we found in other spaces. So for my work, it was my observations in hallways, in coffee rooms, in offices, in the cubicle farms that so many government workspaces actually exist in. And so I even have examples about what can happen in toilets and all of the great work and or cigarette breaks.
Yeah, yeah.
So you learn so much outside of what gets written down in the meetings, the documents that are on public record. And as a trade policy person who worked in multiple different settings, what I saw was absent in academia were all of these other activities that go on a day-to-day basis, the mundane interactions that create the backdrop, but a supporting space where policy work happens and where those documents are produced, where those meetings occur in the hallways and the catching up, as Leanne writes about. And coming to academia after taking a break and working in policy meant that I was mindful of all of these other spaces, places, and times that policy work develops through. That's what I found was missing in academic scholarship.
So what was it sort of cumulative experience that led you to sort of come up with the idea for the book and your research, or was there one particular sort of aha moment for each of you where that might have happened?
I think for me, what happened is when I came back to do a PhD at the University of Edinburgh, I had a supervisor at the time, Richard Freeman, who kindly introduced us all together.
Yeah.
And people had reached out to Richard because of the work that he was doing on a practice and the practice of policy. And he introduced us and we got together. And it came at a moment in time when people were moving onto virtual platforms. So it was 2019, 2020.
Yeah.
And so as COVID was happening and everybody was isolating in their homes, we had already planted the seeds of developing this wonderful relationship of international scholars, usually early career researchers or PhD. And we would come together to discuss our research, but we were also these pra-academics. We were practitioners and academics, and we were sharing our experiences. And it, through these virtual meetings that we were having every month or two, we discovered that we all had a similar experience of not finding ourselves in the academic scholarship.
Yeah.
And how we felt that we needed to bring our voices into this space. And what we found was kind of common was the informal, these informal interactions, but we couldn't agree on what that informal was. We sensed it, but we couldn't clearly articulate it. And everything was slightly different in each of our contexts. So we were hesitant to define it too strictly.
But the other thing about that was because Richard did facilitate us coming together, and I was at Edinburgh Uni doing my PhD as well. But I think it wasn't just about the kind of practices. I also think it was a shared ethnographic sensibility, because all of our work, so we were all mature age practitioners returning, you know, going into doing a PhD, all roughly in the kind of domains of policy, politics, public administration, public management, in those kind of disciplinary, subdisciplinary areas. But we also had, which is unusual for these disciplines and subdisciplines, this kind of ethnographic sensibility. So the sorts of things we noticed because of our practice histories and because of that kind of bringing that sensibility with us, I think was also a really, really quirky combination by coming together online as we did, you know, on those virtual platforms and now ongoing, you know, with those conversations. We were realizing, oh, well, we've got this really interesting combination of, yes, different contexts. And obviously we're doing different research in our individual PhD projects, but we shared this really, I think, interesting and unique perspectives, which I would argue an ethnographic sensibility from an academic point of view is probably the only kind of approach that would enable you to kind of get at this stuff.
I agree, because you need to be able to go into the spaces and places and able to observe, participate, and share collaboratively in the co-creation to be welcomed in and to contribute to.
Yeah, you've got to be present in these things, which we were.
Well, one of the core conceptual themes in the book that you drew on was the vertical bar and creating informality. Perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that.
It's an interesting thing around that punctuation mark. So there's a degree
maybe
of
we should explain since the non-visual element in the podcast.
Yeah, I know. It is a bit of a challenge. And so instead of writing the word informality, or instead of using the, what do you call it?
So you could have a slash between in and formality.
Yeah.
Or you could have brackets around in and then formality. Yeah. Or you could have in hyphen or dash formality. So there's many ways, or you could even italicize in and then not italicize formality or vice versa. So there's many ways of creating a visual effect to show a relationship between the in and formality. We chose to put in a bar. Right. What we were really hoping to do was to highlight how informality and formality are in a constant relationship with each other. And through our experience within different governments, different policy domains, we all witnessed, observed, and participated in how different spaces and places, the formal, the informal, sometimes they were formal in one context and informal in another, were always in a relationship with each other, that they were not two distinct binaries. And so our intention with the bar was to highlight a relationship that was an ongoing, co-produced, contingent relationship between these concepts and their practice.
Could you talk a bit about why has informality traditionally been seen as illegitimate or shadowy?
Yeah, so I think, and it comes actually Mira's paper, so she writes about certain sorts of practices that happen in the public administration and the administration in India of electrical infrastructure. And she highlights from the Global South perspective that the kind of practices and ways of working in certain parts of the Global South years ago got caught up with kind of a rhetoric associated with development that basically said that the certain ways of doing things were less than or not adequate or, you know, not appropriate.
Illegitimate.
And so, you know, and often you'll hear reported things like, you know, informal labour markets and that just assigning holus bolus to whole, you know, nation states, the ways in which ordinary everyday people navigate and live their lives in relation to their housing and their employment is somehow rendered illegitimate and requiring formality. And particularly that's quite loaded too, like the formal what? The formality of the European, particularly kind of the British state, the kind of conventions and codes of practices associated with colonial enterprise, you know, with empire, constructing that binary in such a way that the informal is always about the illegitimate. I mean, it flows through into our context too, where certain sorts of things aren't appropriate. You know, as a public servant, there are certain sort of things that you, conventions in terms of your behaviour, your actions, you need to pay attention to because they're not appropriate. But we wanted to kind of move beyond just that simplistic, you know, saying that these kinds of practices are bad and these kind of practices are good. Actually, what we're trying to do is collapse that and actually say they coexist. And in some instances, how the informal props and scaffolds the formal. That without that, the formal would not be able to kind of operate in the way that we would expect.
I'll give a couple of examples from the book. I think that it's really worth pulling out Eveline's chapter, where she talks about hand gestures and in meetings, specifically infrastructure projects, and how the hand gestures in relation to other material items in the room, say a map, helps to create clarity and communicate really important information between the members who are participating. But what's fascinating is those hand gestures never make it into the meeting minutes. And the meeting minutes are the thing that follows into the future as the legitimate record of what occurred in that meeting. But so much more communication has been happening in that meeting. Or if we bring in Kristen and Larissa's chapter, where they weave together the experience of diplomats in European context about how diplomats are engaging both as people and diplomats all the time. And actually those personal relationships or even just being friendly relationships support the work that can be done by diplomats, but recognizing how in each role, in a shared space, you can move between the diplomatic role to the personal role, but they both work to support the movement forward or the production of diplomatic work. So these are not different spaces or places. They're happening at the same time in the same room.
I was interested, actually, that you drew down examples from different countries, different parts of the world, because you had, you know, Scandinavia, the US, Europe, India, and so on. Did cultural differences make significant impacts on your findings?
I think they're really important. And I think particularly, I think the voices and the stories of the Global South are very critical to kind of really challenging this kind of binaries construct. Because what you find in both Mira's chapter, but also Neha's work, and it's interesting, Neha has got this beautiful chapter about visual ethnography, where she incorporates photography into her work. But she reveals in her chapter kind of the local language. So language, Hindu phrasing and words to describe things, which we don't even have there's nothing equivalent for. We don't kind of have a... And it really is revealing of these really dynamic states that are, you know, that in terms of people's lives to enable things to go on. And we don't have enough of that at all. Like, you know, we are very cognizant that, you know, we've got it too explicit. You know, we've got two explicit empirical pieces from the Global South, and they both are revealing of the kinds of everyday interactions that occur that really challenge our assumptions about what constitutes the informal. And there's a language to it that we don't have. And so I'm very mindful of that our perspectives is also quite partial as well. Like from our stance, our position is insufficient. You know, that there is bound to be, and there will be, other voices from other places that can shed really fascinating insight. We encountered through our work in preparing for the book, particularly in writing up the introduction, some really interesting literature emerging out of post-Soviet settings and the work of the informal in that, which turns a convention in and of its head because of the collapse of the state, but also how the state functioned, the formal functioned. So, you know, we're mindful, we're only in a sense scratching the surface, and we don't have the sorts of voices to really kind of flesh out and build the understanding of how dynamic this is, you know, the relations between the formal and the informal.
I think that's part of the ambition of this book, is also a call to other scholars to engage in their own context and to consider how informal or formal is being used uncritically and the baggage that their use is bringing with it and whether that baggage is appropriate. And so one of the biggest challenges of the book for all of the authors and us as editors was to try to write about formality and informality without labeling stuff as such. So instead of calling it a formal meeting or an informal meeting, it was to try and dig into what made that a formal meeting or an informal meeting. What made this car ride a formal or an informal meeting? What made a document, one or the other, without just using that title at the front end to change the meaning of the item that you're talking about. And whether or not you're using formality or informality, there's many different words that we uncritically use in our scholarship. And what we really wanted to do was push that and ask the authors, ask ourselves when writing about it, how do you describe something without labeling it? To show how the context, how its unique emergence in this situation makes something one or the other. It really pushed us to think, like, why do I think this is informal in this moment?
Yeah. So there's a degree of care that we've tried to apply to ourselves and to curating this and to each other around this, because we know we're also early career scholars, but we're experienced practitioners.
And you and I both draw on creativity in our own research, which probably is why we went to tapestries. And actually the tapestry making required us to be able to use a metaphor, but also a language that helped us to visualize, see, and materialize this concept that we were trying to talk about this relationship between the formal and the informal.
Yeah,
maybe you could talk about that a little bit, actually, because that's interesting.
But yeah, we would be at a total miss
if we didn't do that.
to not talk about the tapestry that we worked with Emma Wheel.
She's a kind of a master weaver level sort of person who gets commissioned to weave major, you know, she does tapestry weaving, does major pieces of work. So she's a well-regarded weaver.
So like how we engaged with all of the authors, everything was a co-production. Everything was collaborative, and we were keen to work in this space where we could discuss, brainstorm, build up, and we went over to Emma's studio and we saw some of her ongoing work. And we actually picked up on a tapestry that she was working on, but she was doing an interpretation of somebody else's interpretation in this piece.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with the colors of this tapestry. It's got some burnt oranges,
this is the one that appears on the cover of the book. It's beautiful.
And so I just was taken with the beauty of this piece and trying to explain policymaking as akin to tapestry making actually made us think about the relationships that we were making and being able to describe it in tapestry terms. And so when you're creating a tapestry and you're weaving, the threads that you're taking move forwards and backwards along the warp.
Yeah, so the warp threads are the vertical threads.
And you're moving your colored threads forwards and backwards. And when you're creating it, you have an intentionality about which will be the front and which will be the back. And the front of it is your intended visual effect. And the back is the knottiness, the messiness that comes. But it can be equally beautiful, but you can't have the front without the back, and you can't have the back without the front, and you can't have any of it without the warps or the wefts that hold it all together. And so our experience as policy practitioners was that we would move between these front-facing and the back-facing all the time. And we were holding it all together as practitioners, as the documents, as the spaces, as the cars, as all of these other material components are also holding the whole policy space together. And so you can't have the front without the back, and you can't have the back without the front. And we were just we were pleased as punch to be able to work with Emerald on this. The back of the book is actually the front of the tapestry. The spine of the book is the side of the tapestry, and the front of the book is the back of the tapestry, showing all of the knottiness. We were just so pleased that we would be able to create this cover. And also throughout the entire book, you see different components of the making, the time, some of the knots, and even some of Emma's hands in it to show the craftsperson brought into the making of the tapestry, not as independent from it, but part of it.
Perhaps you'd like to talk a little bit about your writing journey. I gather it was quite a collaborative process.
It is. And to do that, we want to start with acknowledging all our contributors. We have two other co-editors, Joanna Mason, who is in Sydney, in Australia, Liana Visser, who is in the Netherlands. And, you know, we as a kind of group came together to take this project somewhere. But before I go into kind of how our process of kind of creating it, because it is, and the effort and attention we have paid to it as a kind of collaborative endeavor, just acknowledge the individual contributors. So we have Claire Binner, who is at the University of Edinburgh, who wrote about an interesting experience during the COVID pandemic and the effect it had in public administration. We have Meera Sadaka, who looks at the role of local knowledge in Indian rural electricity governance. We have Kristen and Eagling and Larissa talking about diplomacy. Lisa Marie Borelli, looking at Swiss public administration. We have Neha Mungeha, who was looking at doing a visual ethnography. We have Evelyn Martinez, who was looking at things around engineering, but focusing on these kind of hand movements. And so, yeah, they were all our kind of contributors. But we also asked for some sport insight and reflections from two kind of senior, very, very experienced scholars in this kind of area, sort of domain, and that is Peregrine Schwartz-Say and Dvoriano. They kindly provided an afterword to it. And then we bent back to Richard, who kind of linked us together initially, and he did the foreword to it. Oh, and of course, Emma, with all the wonderful images. We get told about the kind of conventions of writing and publishing and the pressures and all that sort of thing. But we wanted to make a point that we could do some of these things differently. And then how we move through the actual making of the book itself and the sessions we had. Sort of an interviewing selection process.
It was a very doable process. It did require work, but it's doable. And I think that this is something that others should really understand. We also trace this journey in the Dunumal.
Yes, we do.
Tamara and I write a chapter on it that describes how we've done it if others want to follow in our footsteps. We had a conversation with each authorship team to see how they were intending on using it. And this group discussion where the editors all got together and we spoke to them about how they were interpreting it and where they wanted to challenge this concept in their own work. And then we had two workshops, and these were creative workshops because we wanted to really interrogate this concept differently using creative methods.
Now that the book is actually published and it's out there, what would you like policymakers to take away from the book, do you think?
I would love for policymakers to be able to see themselves in the book. And I think that would be a success if they read through it and they could see, yes, I empathize with that. Yes, I recognize that. Having this ethnographic sensibility, we try to describe our own experiences in these settings. And if we actually touch a piece of them where they're like, yes, and to see the different types of work that they're doing is legitimate.
Represented. We're shining a light on your everyday, and some of it's quite mundane. Some of the stuff that I do is really boring. But that's what people do every day, and it's not illegitimate.
Okay, well, thanks very much to both of you.
Yeah.
I think that's actually all we've got time for today.
Thank you for having us.
A huge thanks to Lindsay Garner-Knapp and Tamara Mulhern for your insights on informality and policymaking. If you'd like to find out more, the book is available at emerald.com and at all major online outlets. A full transcript of this episode is also available on the Emerald website. I'd like to thank my colleagues Tom Shields and Rebecca Torr for their support, and the team at This Is Distorted for bringing this episode together. I'm Nick Walwick, and this has been the Emerald Podcast Series. Hope to see you again soon.